Hey there, listener. You know what would be really great? I mean, by golly, fantastic. If you could take 10 seconds right now to give our show a rating, that would be really terrific. However you're listening to this episode right now, Spotify, Apple, Winamp, whatever it is, if you can give us a rating and review, we want it. If you're liking what you're hearing, give us that 5-star rating. If you don't, please keep it to yourself. The point is, rating our show allows us to get discovered more. That's all. Could you do that for me, huh? Could you? Why, thank you so much, listener. I really appreciate you. Welcome to Real Asian Podcast. I am Ray Liu, and I'm joined with Baldwin today. What's up, Baldwin?
What's going on?
What up, man? How you been?
Pretty good. Excited to talk about this movie.
Yes, yes. Actually, I was quite surprised at how taken aback and compelling this movie was. I actually had never heard about it, so I'm really excited. So the movie that we are talking about today is the 2016 Lion, based on a true story. I'll go over the synopsis of the film in case you haven't seen it. If you have seen it, just as a refresher, go through our big take, love it and leave it, same old, and then we'll just go from there. Lion takes place in 1986, where 5-year-old Saru, our main protagonist, has a close relationship with his brother, sister, and mother. One night, Saru tags along with his brother, Gudu, while he goes to work overnight. Gudu asks him to wait at the train station till his return. Saru falls asleep and wakes up alone, thinking that his brother has left him, so he goes and searches for him in an empty train car. He then falls asleep again on the train, which ends up taking him super far away to Calcutta, where he doesn't speak the local language of Bengali. Saru is stranded in this massive city for several weeks, ultimately having a stranger taking him to a police station, which sends him to an orphanage. An Australian couple, Sue and John, adopt him and take him to live with him in Hobart, Tasmania. They also adopt another kid, Mantosh, to be his adoptive brother. 20 years later, Saru goes off to college in Melbourne and starts dating a fellow classmate named Lucy. At a friend's gathering, Saru sees an Indian delicacy that triggers an early memory of his of when he was with his brother. He becomes super emotional and confesses to everyone that he's actually not from Calcutta, but he's actually really lost, explaining to them, or he feels lost, explaining to them how he ended up at the orphanage. His friends give this amazing spur of the moment breakdown of how to create a search radius using Google Earth to find his hometown. Saru becomes obsessed with finding his hometown, so much so that he drifts apart from his family and Lucy. After weeks of searching, he eventually finds it and travels back to the Khandwa district in India and reconnects with his mom and sister. In that moment, he finds out that his beloved brother was actually killed by an oncoming train on the night they were separated. The end. Again, I mentioned that was based on a true story. The movie was actually adapted from the memoirs of Saru. Right. So Baldwin, going to ask you just generally what your overall thoughts of the movie was.
Yeah, so I actually originally saw this movie in theaters back in 2016. And I remember how I felt like at the end. I was like, oh, I'm about to cry, man.
Yeah.
It was super emotional. I thought it was a super powerful, moving film. And you really need to have some emotional range to feel this movie. You can't help but like feel alone while you're watching it. So couldn't help but feel the need to hug someone afterwards. First thing, like something I want to say at the beginning, Sunny Pawar, Saru as a young kid, is cutest kid ever.
Yeah.
I don't know, you'd agree, right?
Definitely.
But yeah, I think what really makes this movie great at its core, if you remove the great performances, the music, all the visuals, it's just an amazing story. And the fact that it's true makes it even more powerful. Saru gets separated from his family, grows up thousands of miles away, and he finds his way home back to his mom, who he was missing from, through Google Earth and through the memory of like his 5-year-old self.
Yeah.
So it's really like finding like a needle in the haystack, really.
I know. Yeah. I think the actual Saru said he spent so many months like searching.
Yeah, it's crazy. And we get to like in the movie, we get to go through the entire emotional journey with him. So it's grounded in the experience of this kid and it's letting it unfold from his own perspective. So it's such incredibly moving story, and it's a primal story too, like the loss of the mother and then reunification with her. Like at that level, it's just amazing in itself. At a human level, you just think like this actually happened to this kid.
Let me go ahead and give you my big takeaway from this film. So when it's all said and done, the dust settles, what does this film kind of portray or represent for me, a big takeaway from me? I think it shows what happens with when you have the level of care and carefulness by the director, Garth Davis. Davis took the time to meet all the people in Saru's life, even when he was there when Saru reconnected with his birth mother. He focused on the tormented character aspect of Saru, giving us the arc that we had hoped for at the beginning of the film, you know, like in a sense of we wanted him to find his family again.
Right.
And the reason why I bring that up is we can, and mentioning director Garth Davis is because he's a white director. So my point is that we can look at this movie and go, oh, it's a white director, white screenwriter, adapting from a book. It's going to suck. You know, more oftentimes than not, right. You know, obviously, when you have non-persons of color try to tell persons of color's story, it falls short or it could be not culturally sensitive. But in this case, it actually did a pretty good job, I thought. And honestly, deep down, I think that's the kind of world that I wish we can kind of get to. I would love to get to a point where it doesn't matter what the color of your skin What doesn't matter the skin color of the director is, as long as it does the story justice. And if that takes surrounding yourself with the people as the director that share that specific story, then do it. Take the time and take the proper steps in surrounding yourself with that, like engrossing yourself with that culture. That's not to say that I don't want people of colors to have directing opportunities, for sure. But I don't think that there's ever going to be a day where we're going to eliminate all, like white directors can't ever direct stories that are of center around people of color. Like I just think that's impractical.
I definitely agree with it. I thought that Garth Davis took a lot of care in his approach to the movie. And I think, yeah, this is like really his only big movie that he's made. And he really went in to the characters and the actual people and interviewed all of them. And then we see at the end of the movie, like there's an actual video of his adoptive mother meeting his birth mother. So that was like super powerful too. So,
yeah. And I know that in the story itself, there's also a little theme of white saviorism that I kind of want to talk about later on. But before we get to that, let's go to our Love It and Leave It segment where we go ahead and talk about one thing that we liked, one thing we didn't. Baldwin, what's your Love It and Leave It?
All right, I actually have a few love it's. They're really quick, but I'll go through them really quickly. So the first love it, I could really appreciate how the whole first half of the movie, they didn't speak English. Oftentimes, studios feel the need to Americanize movies to make it more appealing to Hollywood. But
right.
I like the fact that we didn't have to suspend belief here and make it feel like at least a little bit more authentic. Yeah, so that's my first one. Second one is definitely the soundtrack. Dustin O'Halloran, he's a really, really, really great composer. And the score here was like super emotional with the piano and the strings, super touching. And it really helped me get to feel the movie and connect more with it. So yeah, if you're into that stuff, Dustin O'Halloran, he's a great composer. So look up his music.
Definitely.
And then last one really quick. I also love that the further
lots of love
you get
there.
Yeah. Okay. The further you get into the movie, the more his hair starts to look like a lion.
Yeah. We got the lion's mane. Dev Patel. Yeah,
exactly.
All right. Your leave it.
My leave it. Okay. So one thing I didn't really like was how the movie portrayed. It seemed that Saru really didn't get to, or he didn't feel the pull of his heritage and those memories until he was around his Indian friends. And that's like what prompted him. Like when he saw the Jollibee snack and it sort of jogged his memories, just because I don't really think that's very believable. Like he must have felt really repressed and compartmentalized those memories for that to happen. And I actually learned that according to the book, his memoir, he did have those memories of India throughout his young life, but he just didn't want to tell anyone about them because it sort of touches on the movie too, but he was scared that his parents would have feelings about him missing his family.
Yeah.
So But I think the reason they did that was to sort of capture his reaction on screen. And then I think narratively, it just looks more powerful that way.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I was like thinking this whole time he like tucked away, I mean, which is very possible too. I'm sure people out there don't, they think about it, but they don't really acknowledge it or engage with it until like years later, especially when they're a young adult. And obviously the in a narrative sense, like that delicacy was meant to be like, that's why they focus it so early on in the movie. It's like, oh, this is like such a great thing. It reminds me of my brother. And then he saw it again. And
yeah.
And then also from a film perspective, it's like jumping 20 years later, there's such a huge, like as an audience member, you just think, oh yeah, he hadn't dealt with this in 20 years. So the effect of him finally coming to grips with his, you know, story makes it even more powerful. But for sure, like I have to imagine he probably did think about it throughout his life. Okay, My Love It and Leave It. You mentioned this earlier, Baldwin. I got to give props to the actor who played young Saru, Sunny Pawar. He had a lot of screen time in the first act of the movie, and most of it was alone. And I really felt that this kid, you know, did a good job with the screen time that he had. People of the pod know that I'm always kind of reluctant and skeptical when it comes to child actors, especially if they're going to be alone. Like they're the central focus. Just them. And I was like, oh man, here we go. But he did an amazing job. Mind you, I mean, primarily most of it was running like around India and it's completely lost and stranded. Mm-hmm. You're just like very, very concerned about this kid. But did a good job with his whole screen time as young Saru. So I really love that. My Leave It, I thought the relationship between Saru and Lucy was a bit awkward. It was shorthanded and somewhat disjointed for me. Like I understand Saru has some attachment issues and is like emotionally scarred and everything, but I do think Lucy could have played a stronger role in relation to those things. I felt that she was there, then she wasn't, and then she came back, and then she wasn't, and then there she is again, kind of thing. And I don't know, and you can tell me if you read the memoir, I don't know if there was a real Lucy or a Lucy figure in Saru's life who played a prominent role.
So
if she did, I just would have liked to have her character in the movie have more depth.
Yeah. So what I found out is that Lucy's character is actually sort of a composite of all of the girlfriends Saru had during that time. So there wasn't actually a particular person it was based off of. It was just like a bunch of his girlfriends. But I definitely agree. She was definitely like underwritten in the movie. And it's super awkward at times. Like the part where they sort of first meet and he's walking.
Sort
of like doing the little dancing and flirting kind of thing. That was like super cringy to me.
Yeah. They moved pretty quickly too. I was like, wow.
They're already dating. The front door really quick.
Yeah, I know. And then also the party scene when she's trying to comfort him and he just doesn't really want to be there. That felt a little bit awkward as well. You know, I wasn't actually sure if they were still at the party, but like the way that they were they were clearly in conflict.
It was like it just showed them in isolation and just like the rest of it. So
which might have been an artistic choice.
Yeah, exactly. Like sort of zooming in on their relationship.
But I kept thinking about the other people at the party, probably watching them. Like,
well, like this is weird. It's like, oh, they're that couple.
Yeah, they're like, you guys good? Like, you guys should go home.
he's going through an emotional struggle, man.
I know, right? Yeah, it's like, oh, great. They're kind of at it again. Yeah, so I just felt like the whole relationship was a little bit awkward for me. I think it could have, and that makes sense that it was a composite of composite of people in his life, meaning like they didn't have a central reference to like draw from. They just kind of pulled a bunch of nurturing or like
experiences
into one. You know, but not really having a full picture of like what this, like what one person meant to Saru, which also is kind of funny. It's like, I'm imagining him, which each girl that he's like, playing up the lost mystery guy.
Like kind of thing.
Yeah. He's like, I'm lost and I just want to be found.
You know? Oh my gosh.
We're joking about it now because it's a happy ending ultimately. But yeah, I just like, and I was like, oh my God.
So alluring.
Oh my God, I'll take care of you. I'll take care of you. I can change. I can change you.
I'll save you.
He's like, I need saving. I'm lost. What did you think about the scene with when young Saru, when he was running around and then he ran into that the lady who was nice to him at first, and then like mm-hmm. that weird guy came in.
That was super weird because they seemed really nice, right?
Yeah,
they did some creepy stuff to in his presence, and then they talked about how he's just what they're looking for. So I think it's super ambiguous. Maybe it's that way because Saru himself didn't know what their intentions were. Like, mm-hmm. were they going to sell him as a slave or some sort of indentured servitude?
Or like sex trafficking?
Yeah, sex trafficking. Or like maybe it was for like an adoption agency. Like,
but like underground.
It wasn't so bad. Yeah, I don't know. You can't help but wonder, right?
And he was like, and then he like came like laid next to him. And I was like, oh,
yeah, that was
no.
really weird.
Oh,
and just like sort of touched his limbs and all that. It was really too close for comfort.
So awkward. I was like, oh no, where is this going? I kept thinking because I didn't see the movie before. I was like, oh man, mm-hmm. this is going to turn.
Okay, yeah. You thought it was going to get
real bad.
Turn really sad. I mean, I would assume that he didn't have great intentions. But I do think that this is one instance where the movie does a good job of showing the different levels of child exploitation and poverty in India.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we also saw kids at the orphanage, the kids that were sleeping in the subway tunnel, and they were taken by like who knows what they're taken for. Like, it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And then we saw the statistic too. In India, there's over 80,000 children that go missing each year. And then I found another statistic that said 8 million children are in poverty and living on the streets in India. So
damn,
you can't help but feel really sad for those kids because their situation just seems so hopeless, and there's so many of them that it seems never ending.
What year was that stat?
It came out during the movie, so 2016 probably.
Oh yeah, there was like the ending text at the end of the movie, right?
They talked
about missing children.
But yeah, it kind of reminds me of the rooster coop in The White Tiger, if you remember.
Yeah.
Like at a certain point, I think that they know that there's so little hope, but they just sort of like let things happen to them because it's so ingrained in them. They don't know what else to do.
Yeah. And I know it's unfortunate. I personally don't know enough about Indian history or even politics, if it is a political issue. I'm sure it is. There's some kind of political root to it, but how so many children are targets and are preyed upon on the streets and stuff like that. And then, you know, this movie didn't really actually go into all of that. It showed a lot of that, but it still stayed focused with one character, one aspect, one person's story, you know, and kind of gave some broader backdrop to the whole issue, but didn't spend too much time on it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go. I just want to talk about performances across. There's actually, there was, some of the actors were nominated, and actually this film was nominated for multiple awards as well, the Academy Awards. Let's talk about Dev Patel. What did you think?
So I want to preface it first with this, I think like how his character ended up in his story. So Dev Patel, he comes in during the second half of the movie. And firstly, I thought Saru's character got a lot less interesting. But what I mean by when I say that is that I'm not as interested in like the person they became. And I think this is because the movie shifts its focus from Saru's personality to more of his like internal struggle.
Yeah.
And like young Saru, I was super compelled by this kid. He was super likable and really commanded my attention. But with adult Saru, what was really driving the rest of the movie, I felt, was like, how will his story play out and what's going to be its conclusion? Like, that's what I was looking for. So in that sense, I thought Dev Patel brought a lot of depth to the role.
Mm-hmm.
You can really see him feeling like some type of way when that scene where he's being asked, like, where were you born? Where are you from? Yeah. I do think it showed him moping around a little too long. But then again, there's like that internal struggle there that's understandable at that age, where he's trying to find himself. Mm. And I do think that Dev Patel did a really good job of showing that struggle.
Your take is interesting. I didn't think about it like that. But his performance alone, just his performance, I thought he displayed pretty solid emotional performance. I think we agree on that. It was kind of strange, or not strange, but it was interesting seeing him as a young 18-year-old in Slumdog Millionaire here with like a full-on long hair and thick-ass mustache. It just kind of caught me off guard at first, but ultimately in a good way, because he was able to kind of display this deep, this like emotional performance. You can feel that his evolution as an actor, having early success in a movie like Slumdog Millionaire, right? To this call for dramatic performance. He easily could have just taken his laurels and chill, which oftentimes happens with early success. Mm-hmm. But I think he really flexed his talent in this one. But in terms of the portrayal of the character, or maybe just the character itself on the second half of the movie, there were moments when I was watching where I did think to myself, I just really care about him going on this journey to go find his mom. I didn't really care about anything else, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what you mean by it, though.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Like his, I guess it's like I wasn't really too interested in his life outside of that journey, you know, like his relationship with his parents. It's interesting to see, but like I wasn't really like too into that aspect of it. I just wanted to know like what's going to happen to him. Is he going to find his birth mother? Is he going to find his original, you know, the town that he's from, Ganeshtale? Like that's what I was interested in.
Mm. What are your thoughts on, speaking of which, what are your thoughts on Rooney Mara, the actress who played Lucy?
I mean, we talked about this. It was fine, you know. She didn't really have a lot to work with, right?
Yeah.
Her character was really just there to be a soundboard for Saru, someone for him to talk to, like an emotional counterpart. But yeah, like there's nothing really special there. I think she did a good job with what she had to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know much of Rooney Mara's work, to be honest. I read that she was in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Side Effects, and The Social.
She's a really great actress for sure. I
saw The Social Network, but I don't remember her. I didn't see The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Have you?
You should watch that. That's one of my favorite movies, actually. So I definitely recommend it. She's pretty amazing in that.
But her role in this one, as I mentioned, a little disconnected from the core emotion of the movie. Performance-wise, she worked with the material that she had. It wasn't bad, but it just didn't really stand out for me. I also learned that her great-grandparents are the owners of the Giants and Pittsburgh Steelers.
Oh, yeah. The Maras. It's crazy.
That's born into privilege for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Not an argument. She's talented. She's definitely talented, but definitely had a nice big safety net in case shit didn't work out. Let's just be real.
She had some good emotional support, you know.
Yeah,
or financial support.
Very big financial support for sure. Okay, and then Nicole Kidman. I was surprised to see Nicole Kidman in this movie, just because it's like I feel like someone who Nicole Kidman in a movie like this, this movie probably, you know, would have just been way more, like, talked about a lot more. Mm-hmm. Or am I wrong to think that?
Yeah, I mean, I think just her name itself, it has a lot of gravitas. So I guess you would expect the movie to focus on her a little bit more. And instead, like, she really does become a supporting character for Saru. And she does really supports the plot as well.
One of the most prominent actors in our time, right? Nicole Kidman is big time. It was great to see someone like her, of her caliber, attached to this film and as a supporting actor. I think she was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, right?
Yep.
She didn't get a lot of screen time, but definitely maximized the opportunities when she did. Kind of starts off as like this beacon of hope for Saru, and she's got the 80s hair. Australian 80s hair. Bright, motherly, all this good stuff, nurturing. And then you see her health kind of deteriorate, seeing how she's like worried for Saru. And I thought that she was going to die. I'm glad that she didn't, but it was believable. Oh, it was believable that she was obviously, something was killing her inside. she probably...
Yeah, she was very fragile.
Yes, yeah, very fragile. And then, like, the whole thing with Saru, and obviously Mantosh not necessarily falling in line with the family dynamics. Just to kind of, when they adopted Saru, Saru became, like, their poster child, and then Mantosh was not so much. He was kind of an outsider to the family.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
Yeah, I know, it's pretty sad. But yeah, I think overall her performance was really great.
I also really felt her maternal instincts in the movie. Like, they were really strong there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because, like, I read she actually adopted kids in her real life before. So that's definitely an experience that she pulled from really well. Yeah, the overwhelming sense I got from her character was to protect and nourish her kids with support. And at the same time, sort of embody the challenges and the heroism to a certain extent of being an adoptive parent. So I thought it was like a really, really good layered performance by Nicole Kidman.
Annie's Tea Cakes is an Oakland-based food company on a mission to provide plant-based Chinese food options to the world. As a longtime plant-based eater, Annie started this business to create a way for herself and others to enjoy the foods often shared with family but don't fit a plant-based diet. The journey started with vegan Taiwanese pineapple cakes. Follow Annie's Tea Cakes on Instagram or go to annie'steacakes.com to place your order today.
So I want to talk about this. It's something that kind of came to mind. We talk about usually these things before. Thoughts on the white saviorism aspect of the film. Is this a good case of it? Does it even apply? So again, just for added context, an Australian couple, white Australian couple, comes to or adopts a child, takes a child out of poverty and hardship in India and raises them, puts them in a much more favorable environment, if you will.
Yeah,
this is the definition of it, and I pulled this from the internet. This is from sociologist, I believe, Matthew Huey. A white savior film is often based on some supposedly true story. Second, it features a non-white group or person who experiences conflict and struggle with others that is particularly dangerous or threatening to their life and livelihood. Third, a white person, the savior, enters the milieu and through their sacrifices as a teacher, mentor, lawyer, military hero, aspiring writer, or wannabe Native American warrior is able to physically save or at least morally redeem the person or community of folks of color by the film's end. Examples of this genre include films like Glory, Dangerous Minds, Amistad, Finding Forrester, The Last Samurai, Half Nelson, Freedom Riders, Gran Torino, Avatar, The Blind Side, The Help. Avatar. Oh, yeah, Avatar.
I read that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, the white guy.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, at first I didn't think it applied because it felt more like an element to this to the movie and not really the focus of the story. But, you know, after reading a little bit more on it, I definitely think it does apply. I mean, it's like, it's exactly what happened, like a white character rescuing a non-white character from their impoverished situation. The thing about it, though, I don't think that it's the essence of the story. And it doesn't really linger on that narrative. It's more just a part of the plot, part of the story. It's not like they show dozens of white parents adopting and saving Indian kids. It's just one. And actually, I think it's even more or less used to highlight the disconnect or the conflicts that might arise from that sort of situation. You know, this white couple saving an Indian boy and taking him away from his country, his heritage, and it actually resulted in an identity crisis for him. Yeah, I guess overall, I think that this is a case of white saviorism, but the movie does a good job of not turning that into a trope.
Yeah, because sometimes we think of white saviorism, it's a pejorative term. So most of the time it's negative. And the example that this sociologist gave is pretty spot on. Like Gran Torino, we did an episode of that, and there's definitely an aspect of white saviorism, right? Even though Clint Eastwood's character is super racist, like, he's still a savior because he saves this Hmong family. even though there is a white person that does technically save Saru and Mantosh from their circumstances, perhaps a key distinction is that Saru controls his redemption story. So Sue does rescue him from his situation, but it's not like she takes care of his whole life and is like, let me just take care of everything and bring you onto this white life and everything over there in India was bad or anything like that. Does not portray that at all. We do see Saru more in control of his narrative. It was his, on his own accord, wanting to reclaim his identity, reclaim his roots, right? Find his birth mother. And it was also, we also see that his adoptive mother, Sue, was fully supportive of it and even empathetic to his cause. Yeah. And so, yes, there is a white savior aspect of it. I guess it doesn't necessarily apply to the common definition of it in a negative way. I guess it really clicked in my mind when why it didn't count as like a white savior film, and I don't know if this is valid or not, you can let me know, is that there was a part in the movie where I think Saru thought that the reason why Sue, his adoptive mother, adopted him was because she was infertile. She like biologically couldn't have kids.
Yeah.
But then she explains like, no, it wasn't that. It was just because there's too many humans on Earth. So she's like, I don't want to bring another one in. And instead, I'll take one out of a dire situation on Earth. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting way to look. I mean, if you think about it, it's a very practical way of looking at it.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of framing white saviorism. I agree.
That's true. There's like a logic and reason to it. You're like, oh, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, yeah. But I thought that was really interesting. And then just made me think about in like the environment. I was like, yes, there's way too many humans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Last thing we want to talk about the whole movie, talking about reclaiming your roots, your identity. I want to ask you, have you ever sought to understand your roots, your heritage, your legacy?
My legacy.
Your legacy. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, personally, I have thought about it, honestly, like my entire life. So I'm Cambodian, so is my family. And they all immigrated to America as refugees from the genocide of the 1970s, which is like from the Khmer Rouge. Mm-hmm. And I never really experienced that myself. But even though I never experienced that, I still feel it with me, like it's in my blood. It's passed down to me from my parents, and I carry it around with me in small ways through things like my relationship with my family, through generational trauma, and the pressure I have to succeed because of everything my family went through to get here. So I've always sort of wanted to see where I came from and what my roots are, and just to like better understand the journey my family took to get me here to where I am today. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, like, I also feel like I've repressed that urge too as I was growing up, just like Saru did.
Yeah.
You know, after thinking about it, I feel like it's because I didn't want to carry that with me, just like the heaviness of it, right? So I thought it was like necessary to let it go.
Mm.
But yeah, I think the urge to understand your roots is in everybody, really. Like, no matter where you're from, it's innate primal feeling.
Yeah. And that's why there's 23andMe and Ancestry. And that's
yeah, exactly.
Big.
And it's why like Saru's story connects so much with people, like seeing his journey from like finding his journey of finding home and understanding who he is and then succeeding in that. Like he's able to reclaim his past and sort of merge these two conflicting identities. And that's something that's super powerful because it's like a level of self-actualization that we're all searching for, really, I feel.
You've been back to Cambodia, right?
Yeah, so I actually went back to Cambodia for the first time in 2019, so about two years
ago. Oh, wow, that recent. Oh,
recently, okay. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Had your family been back there since too?
Some of my family have. My mom has only been back once, and that's because my grandmother died, so she went back to visit. And it was like she emigrated to America in 1988, 89. And then her first time back was in like 2004 or something. And yeah, she's told me too, like she's kind of scared to go back there, just like the memories that she had from, you know, being a refugee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you were over there, did you seek out like where your family home was or area, sit town?
Some parts of it I did, but I actually didn't get a chance to see the actual like village and the home that my grandma lived in.
Far away from the tourist area.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah. So I went to Siem Reap, and then where their village was closer to Phnom Penh, which is the capital. So
yeah.
I didn't get to see it, but I am like still, it's still something that I definitely want to go to.
Yeah. I would love to visit Cambodia. I've not been. I had a similar journey or experience. For those who don't know, I'm half Chinese, half Vietnamese. When I was young, I primarily kind of leaned and focused more on my Chinese side of... Oh, I mean, first of all, I was like, I want to be American. Like, that's just what I believed when I was younger. Like, I was an American kid, American culture, American everything, right? But I was also... aware of my Chinese heritage. I was aware that I was half Vietnamese, but for some reason I just didn't really care that much and think much too much about it. It wasn't until probably as I got much older, I started to recognize that, you know, I'm appreciative of my Chinese culture. And I'm also very appreciative of my Vietnamese culture. If anything, I like Vietnamese food way more than I like Chinese food. I like Chinese food a lot, but Vietnamese food is like up there for me.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I went back to Vietnam in 2018, I think. I think it was 18 for the first time, never been. I went alone, solo, and it was it did start off as kind of like a find your roots and journey kind of reason to like go back there and try to connect more with my culture. So before I left, I got the address from my aunt, my mom, of where they grew up in Vietnam. And it was in South Vietnam, it was in Ho Chi Minh City. But I also kind of explored all, I flew into Hanoi and then went down south. When I got to Vietnam, I had to like, basically they have this Grab app, which is basically like their Uber over there. Mm-hmm. They probably had it too when you were in Cambodia. It's like the Southeast Asian Uber.
We didn't use it. We used the tuk-tuks to get everywhere.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've heard of that too. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So I took out there to this address, and it was kind of, I forget the district. It was like District 4 or something like that, which is basically not the tourist area. Because in Ho Chi Minh City, it's either District 1 or like District 10 or like the tourist areas. So District 4, I went out there and immediately I stood out. Like all the local people were just like looking at me like, clearly this guy's probably lost.
Really? Like, tourists are there, right?
Yeah, no tourists. And I stuck out like a sore thumb. You know, I had like a tank top and shorts and, you know, I was pretty tall too. And I was like tatted up. And so a lot of these people were like, this guy clearly is not from around here. But overall, when I did go there, it actually wasn't a home anymore. It had turned into a barber shop.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I had to like make sure I was at the right spot. Like I'm looking at my map and I was like, this is it, right? I'm pretty
You're
sure.
You're like Saru, huh? When he went back to his home, it's like,
exactly. I was a little disappointed. I was like, damn, I wish there was actually a home here. But it was that. I texted the picture to my mom. She's like, that is it. And I was like, yeah, it's a barber shop now. And she's like, oh, well, that's too bad. And that was that.
Did you get a haircut there? Come full circle.
They've probably just given me a number two and number one just all around. But to be honest, I did not have my eat, pray, love moment.
Yeah.
Because I think Vietnam had changed so much, you know, like I've changed so much. Overall on the trip, I endeared myself to the people, the locals, the surroundings and everything like that, the food, but I still felt like an outsider.
I kind of like have those same experiences too. Like, I'm trying to go on this own like individual personal journey and trying to find some sort of meaning or sort of fulfillment in it. And I think that the way we sort of romanticize that idea, it sort of like hypes it up a little bit too much. It always ends up in a little bit of a disappointment, right?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think it's because we're both movie watchers.
Yeah.
So like, it's like, I want that moment where the camera pans around me 360.
A tear drops down my eye.
Yeah. This is it. I found my home.
Yeah, and then life is all good again.
Like, you go back, you get a promotion in your job. You know, everything happens perfectly for you. Your relationships are better.
You write a book and then make a movie about you.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't have that moment.
Yeah.
I will say it was more of like a combat, like, in retrospect, when I think about that trip, I did have a lot of little moments where I felt like where I belonged in my environment. I remember I did do some touristy things, but I actually didn't do too much. The type of traveler that I am is like, I have a light itinerary, but other than that, though, I kind of just go with the flow. And I remember multiple nights in Vietnam, especially in South Vietnam, in Ho Chi Minh City, I went to a restaurant and sat down, and I think it was the owner, like kind of sat down next to me and just like started talking to me. We just started having this nice conversation, talking about our culture and heritage. And he was like originally South Vietnamese when it was still Saigon. And then when the communists basically took over and won, there was still some kind of like resentment and all of that. But, you know, he like owned a business and all that. And just having that conversation, those were the moments where I felt really it was mind expanding and a little bit of that self-actualization, but no aha, like big eat, pray, love moment. I didn't climb on top of a mountain, just like, throw my arms out.
No, I think that's great though. I think we should really like normalize those moments more and like highlight them, because they're really the ones that, like you said, are more mind expanding. And I feel like gives us a deep appreciation of why we're there, where we came from, and gives us meaning in the whole experience.
Yeah. Any thoughts about the role of technology in this film? I think it's very subtle, but if you think about how they use Google Earth, I wonder if it was a slight product placement, but it's interesting how when they adapted from the novel to the movie, much of the novel or the memoirs, Saru, I think they talked about how he goes through hours and hours of Google searching and a lot of internet time.
Yeah.
But when they were adapting it over into a film, they didn't want to just have it just him, like a majority of the film, just like on the computer, just like and just like looking at the screen. He's just like that. And I think that's why they made it to, he started using paper maps, you know, to give it more of like a dramatic effect. Like, oh, he's drawing it down. He's surrounded by that, not on a tiny little screen. So, but yeah, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually do think technology played a really huge role in it. It's just like so powerful for him to get lost as a kid when he's 5 years old. And then 25 years later, like he didn't do any effort to find his family beforehand, but now like they have the capability to do that. And I feel like it's an amazing achievement of technology, really.
Yeah, like what, even though he spends hours and hours of searching on Google Earth, and it seems the task seems seemingly impossible, right? But if you think about, if he didn't have that application, the only other way would have been to physically go to India and run around India, which would have taken up so much time and resources.
It's a huge country. Yeah, like if he didn't have Google Earth, I don't think there would have been any way for him to find his home, unless he literally spent the rest of his life like searching for it.
Yeah, just like walking around India and just like asking people and all that stuff. That would have been impossible. Yeah. I mean, very possible, sure, but
yeah, that would have been 40 years later. Yeah, that would be a great movie.
Yeah, it's just him like walking around. He's like, you know where this is. You know where this is. You know where this is. But yeah, having that technology at hand, very powerful. It kind of reminds me of the movie that we did with Searching. You know how technology could be used as a tool. I mean, technology should be used as a tool, but it's a very exaggerated version of how it can hurt or help you.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing how filmmakers use technology, modern technology at that, to subtly be a integral part of the story without necessarily being the focus of it, you know?
Yeah. And I thought it was really, like, really cool the way they did it too, like towards the end of the movie, where it's showing pictures from Google Earth of the actual terrain, and then it sort of flips back to the actual terrain of the the scenery, like cinematic view of it, and goes back and forth between that. I thought that was like super
like you
cool.
see it's like oh you see that you see yeah. that yeah yeah
yeah
well thanks Baldwin for jumping on this pod today. Lovely conversation as per usual.
Yes sir.
Thank you for listening, y'all. Tune in next time for another episode of Real Asian Podcast. Take care.
Peace.
Lion.